mornings, I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today, clean energy. It's one of the biggest buzzwords these days, but how much of an impact is it really having? And how much potential does it really hold? Also this morning, to your health, what if we told you that 1 in 5 people have an inherited condition that could lead to a heart attack or stroke, but routine screening is rarely done? In case you missed it, the annual benefit auction for Findlay's Hope House is coming up Friday evening. The event is sold out, but you can still participate through the online auction. We'll explain how. And in honor of Earth Day later this month, how to have a lawn and landscape that's both beautiful and eco-friendly. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Wednesday, April 10th, 2024. So one final story here on the eclipse Monday. I saw this item. The Akron Zoo says that its Galapagos tortoises were not feeling frisky during the eclipse. Apparently this is a thing. This was one eclipse story that I had not heard anything about until I saw this morning on the Newswire. Apparently in past years, Galapagos tortoises are known for beginning to breed during eclipses. Who knew? But apparently that is has been a trigger in the past for the Galapagos turtle to get in the mood. The eclipse put them in the mood. And the behavior, they say, is fairly easy to identify. I mean, these are the largest tortoises on the planet, and they are very slow moving. So when they start to get a little frisky, you know it. And they kind of expected that during this eclipse because that's what's happened in the past. But apparently that was not the case this time around. The zoologists say that the tortoises just basically stood there staring at the sky like the rest of us. And that was pretty much it. So no breeding for the Galapagos tortoises. How did I miss that story? That's what I want to know. How did I miss that story leading up to the eclipse? Let's see. Speaking of Northeast Ohio, I saw this item on the Newswire. Among the first things you need to know, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day, the city of Cleveland has designated the former home of Jesse Owens as a historic landmark. Apparently, Jesse Owens lived at the home at the time he won 4 gold medals at the 1936 Olympics in Berlin, Germany. The Cleveland Restoration Society now plans to work with the home's current owner on renovation plans to bring back some of the history from the Jesse Owens era. So, I mean, we think of Jesse Owens, I think most people think Ohio State, not so much Cleveland, but that's where he lived when he set those records. So kind of interesting there. Some of the other most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day. Okay, so we're getting into prom season year before too long. And this is the time of year when teenagers will line up their prom dates. Now, when I was that age, if you wanted to ask a girl to prom, you just asked a girl to prom. You know, either after class or in between classes in the hallways or whatever, you just, hey, you want to go to prom? And that was pretty much it. These days, and I think it's driven by social media and everyone wants their 15 minutes of fame, everybody tries to outdo themselves with these increasingly elaborate promposals. That's the big thing for this generation of teenagers. And the Empire State Building for teenagers in New York, the Empire State Building has put together a promposal package for romantic teens. Basically, this is the package. They'll take you up to the 86th floor observatory for a photo op with the huge letters prom with a question mark. That's, you know, they kind of think prom, you know, it's so they got these huge prom letters to send out the invitation in style from the 86th floor observatory of the Empire State Building. And then They will serve up complimentary sparkling cider to celebrate her yes. When she says yes, they'll, you know, sparkling cider, because they can't drink, so it's just sparkling cider, but you get the cider. And then, once they have that special moment, the couple can make their way up to the 102nd floor outdoor observation deck to take in the 360-degree views of the city. And the building, the Empire State Building, says the event will continue now through May for interested teens. And it will only cost $250. $250 you're going to charge teenagers for a photo op, sparkling cider, and a trip to the 102nd floor deck to see the city. $250. But that's not individual. That's for a couple. So it's only really $125 a piece. So, man, $250 a couple. Are you kidding? Man. Not everybody trying to cash in on these things. So if you, if you're in New York and you're interested and you've got some deep pockets, not like prom doesn't already cost enough, there you go. So, what was it, last week, the end of the week, or on Saturday that the big Powerball jackpot was given away? It was one person. I don't remember where it was now. It wasn't here, I know that. Anyway, one big ticket sold for the $1.25 billion jackpot. There were a number of $1 million jackpots in the Powerball drawing, and one Maryland man is actually $2 million richer after accidentally buying two identical Powerball tickets. He told lottery officials that he purchased the ticket from a 7-Eleven store in Annapolis and apparently mistakenly used the lottery terminal's replay feature, which will print duplicate tickets with the same numbers. And it's meant for those who want to play the same numbers over and over and over again for multiple drawings. He apparently unintentionally bought two tickets with the same numbers for the same drawing. And luckily for him, they were the winning numbers. And since he had two tickets, they were each $1 million winners. So he gets $2 million. So that's a happy accident. I've often said, and I don't play the lottery, but I have often said that if I did, it would certainly make sense to buy at least two tickets with the same number for these giant drawings. Because you know how it works. If multiple players hit the same numbers and hit the jackpot, then they split it evenly. And for the cost of one additional ticket, you could get double your share. You know, you could double your share of the jackpot. And if you're the only winning ticket, you'd still get the full jackpot, but you guarantee that you would get at least twice the share. I think it's a smart strategy. I mean, smart as playing the lottery goes. I mean, it's still incredible odds against winning the lottery, but you get where I'm going with this. Yeah, it makes sense to double up and, get double the money if you have to split it with someone else, or if you hit the $1 million winner. Everybody else is collecting $1 million. You're collecting $2 million because you were smart enough to buy two tickets. This guy did it accidentally, but I think it's a smart thing. And lastly this morning, among the first things you need to know, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to start your day, a new survey of 5,000 Americans has identified the most and least eco-friendly states. April, of course, we've got Earth Day coming up. April, known as Earth Month. And today we have this eco-friendly thing going on. The theme today, talking about clean energy and how to have an eco-friendly lawn and landscape, you know, and so on. So we've got this little theme going here today. So why not throw this out? This survey finds
that the most eco-friendly states are New Mexico, California, Oregon, Delaware, Massachusetts, Vermont, Washington State, Florida, Maryland, and Rhode Island. Now, this is the way it worked. On a scale of 0 to 10, respondents were asked how environmentally conscious they consider themselves to be on a day-to-day basis. Now, I don't know how deep they dug into this to find out if they actually were eco-friendly, just how eco-friendly they consider themselves to be, how eco-conscious they consider themselves to be. In New Mexico, individuals there rated themselves a 5.7, and that was right at the top of the list. California and Oregon at a 5.5, Delaware, Massachusetts, Vermont, and Washington, 5.4, Florida, Maryland, and Rhode Island at 5.3. Almost a fifth of the people in the poll, 5,000 Americans split evenly among the states, almost a fifth said their worries about the environment keep them up at night. Say they lose out on 3 hours of sleep per week worrying about the environment. 3 hours per week of lost sleep worrying about the environment. Now, if you're saying to yourself, I don't lose sleep over this. No, you probably don't, because Ohioans ended up 46th out of the 50 states on the list in terms of eco-friendly. So we are among the least eco-concerned in the state of Ohio, 46th out of 50. So, but on the good side, of all of the things that are keeping us up at night, that is not one of them. There you go. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Wednesday morning started.
WFIN News, I'm Matt Demchek. Your WTOL 11 weather. Mostly cloudy today, a high in the mid-60s. Showers tonight, a low in the mid-50s. Big changes are coming to the Interstate 75 County Road 99 interchange on the north end of Findlay. And the Ohio Department of Transportation invites the public to hear details of the project. ODOT will be holding a public meeting regarding the new Diverging Diamond interchange on Tuesday, April 16th at 1 p.m. at Owens Community College. A formal presentation will begin at 1, followed by a Q&A with project staff. Work on the new Diverging Diamond Interchange will begin this spring and be completed in 2026. Get more information about how Diverging Diamond Interchanges work in the story on our website. There was an accident at Poet Bioprocessing in Lipsick on Tuesday. The company says it experienced an event in a distillation unit and emergency officials responded to the scene. Nobody was injured in the incident. Poet says it's proud of its team members who acted quickly to ensure the safety of their coworkers and notify emergency responders. Get more in the story on our website. People in East Palestine, Ohio, could receive hundreds of millions of dollars in a class action lawsuit related to last year's Norfolk Southern train derailment, which forced temporary evacuations.
Norfolk Southern agreed to pay $600 million in this lawsuit settlement. The company says both businesses and people will be able to use money from this settlement. However, they want to address any negative effects left by the derailment, including health care needs and property restoration. A judge still must approve this settlement.
ONN's Tracy Townsend reporting. The Hope House benefit auction Hope Shines Bright will be held on Friday at the Hancock Hotel.
Over 80% of the people that we serve that successfully complete our programs are still housed a year later. We're giving them more tools in their toolbox so that they can stay on their own 2 feet.
Development Director Lori Pullen says Hope House assists with securing safe and affordable housing for more than 3,500 people annually. Learn more about the benefit auction in this story on our website. Remember, you can always get more news online anytime at WFIN.com.
Well, certainly clean energy is one of the biggest buzzwords these days, whether we're talking about the economy, the environment, politics, or some combination of all of the above. But what is it? How widespread is it? Is its use? What kind of impact is it really having? Joining us this morning is the CEO of the American Clean Power Association, Jason Gramey. Jason, let's kind of go through those basic questions. First of all, what all falls under the category of clean energy, clean power? Kind of define this for us.
Sure. Well, thank you, Chris. And we are definitely, as an industry, we are buzzing, right? So just to kind of provide context, the United States produces more energy than any country in the world. What people may not know is that by far the fastest growing part of our energy economy is clean power. We're talking about solar power, wind power, the battery facilities that are making sure the power gets where we need it, when we need it. In the last year, over 3/4 of the new electricity brought online in this country are from clean power sources. So this is not a niche industry, right? This is a big time core aspect of the American economy. There's enough clean power produced today to run half of the homes in the country. It's about 16% of the nation's total energy. And we can talk about the economics, but it is all about growth. You know, just to kind of give you a little sense, we have 500,000 people working in this industry today, and we need to hire 500,000 more in the next 10 years. And so it is both a growth opportunity for the nation, but a lot of jobs and opportunity in local and rural communities, which is something that we're really excited about.
You reference economic benefits. There are a couple of different prongs on that. First of all, talking about the economic benefits that you see clean power bringing to communities, to industries that are using it.
First of all, this is affordable and kind of predictable power, right? One of the great things about these technologies is the fuel is free. Once you build the facility, you are not vulnerable to the whims of Mr. Putin or OPEC, which, as your listeners know, can cause gasoline prices to go up and down by, 50% a year. So it is a predictable source of affordable power. Another thing that people need to think about is it also saves a lot of money on healthcare, right? This is power that does not create air pollution, and it's also obviously a critical technology and part of the climate solution. So we're seeing that, businesses are benefiting from the reliable power. Communities are really benefiting from the economic opportunity. And, you can think about really almost kind of three types of economic growth. There are construction jobs, right? These are major facilities that, require hundreds of people for multiple years often to get them up and running. There are then the jobs that are, necessary to operate the facilities.
Mm-hmm.
And then a piece that people are not paying enough attention to is this is a renaissance in American manufacturing. In the last year, there's been $500 billion of private sector capital committed to clean energy, a lot of it going into manufacturing facilities. There have been 130 new facilities that have been kind of opened or invested in the last 18 months. And this is building the wind blades and the solar panels and the safety systems and the electronics for use here in the U.S., but this is also being exported globally. Because, of course, the whole world is interested in being part of the clean energy transition.
Yeah, that actually was the other prong that I was going to mention, the economic impact of the industry itself, which you just addressed. You mentioned that this is one of the big buzz thing. I mean, this is an industry that is growing. But how do you respond to critics who say that the only reason that clean energy is growing is that it is being subsidized in order to compete in the marketplace, that this is not a viable effort absent those subsidies? Isn't there an argument to be made that we should just put this out there in the open free market, let the free market decide?
So, look, it's a really important question. The clean energy industry was booming before the recent congressional legislation. It is obviously accelerating the deployment of these technologies. And if there were such a thing as a free market, we'd love to be part of it. We need all sources of energy. We need dramatic increases in clean power. We continue to rely a great deal on natural gas, which we're going to for a long time. Hydropower is important. Every aspect of the American energy sector has enjoyed subsidies. Most for, many, many, many decades. So the kind of, my subsidy is better than your subsidy snit doesn't really express, I think, the broad interest of the nation, which is to figure out how we bring the best attributes of all these technologies together. And you can get off on conversations about whether the clean benefits are, you know, priced into the economy, and people used to talk about carbon taxes. Mm-hmm. I think that the kind of core of the American imagination is about innovation and investment, and having the federal government create a stable environment for that private sector investment, which again, $500 billion of private sector investment. That's not a subsidy. That's American industry and ingenuity. So we feel really good about being part of that energy economy. And the only way we're going to, you know, achieve our goals is with really rapid growth.
You mentioned that we're going to need an all of the above strategy when it comes to energy for the foreseeable future. You're talking about renewable sources, wind, solar. You're talking about natural gas. You're talking about all of the above, fossil fuels, and so on. What is the equilibrium within our lifetime? I mean, within the next 20, 30 years, do we get to the point where we phase out fossil fuels or we phase out natural gas? I mean, what is the projection in terms of percentages here for clean energy, realistically?
So, yeah, look, so, you know, we all have the same goals, right? Clean, affordable, reliable, and secure. And it's a race. You know, the pace with which renewable power can displace other forms of energy is going to depend on how fast we can get the transmission infrastructure necessary to get the power from where it's produced to where it needs to go. It's going to depend on whether we continue to make the rapid advancements in battery storage so that when it's, you know, dark outside, right, we don't have reliability. So there's a technology question on the renewable side, and there's a clean question on the gas side, right? There's a lot of commitment and ambition that you can use natural gas in a way that is consistent with our environmental goals, that you can stop the methane from leaking, mm-hmm, and that you can capture the pollution that comes out of the smokestack and sequester it. And if that works, game on. You're going to see natural gas part of our national economy for maybe forever. It's going to come down to the economics. You know, I think that we ultimately believe that technologies that are inherently clean are going to be more economic than having to retrofit technologies that have, you know, combustion and pollution. But game on, right? Like, you know, our hope is that we have advancements in nuclear and natural gas and hydro and renewables, because that's going to make the solution a whole lot easier than if one technology has to shoulder, you know, all the burden.
Are there any industries where this has yet to really take hold? You know, I'm thinking we see companies that that build their own solar fields or wind farms. We've got communities that are investing in this to add to the grid in general. But are there sectors where this has not really caught on yet? I'm thinking maybe agriculture, things of that nature.
So, I mean, you know, two important parts of the question, right? The first half is, I think, identifying the reality that a lot of this is being driven by consumer demand, right? Communities want predictably priced clean power, and mm-hmm, they're looking for opportunities, which Congress has now created to, you know, be investors in that. A lot of the growth in the power sector, which you point to, is coming from the big tech companies, which are, you know, going to be needing a lot more electricity in the years to come.
Right.
They're very committed. So they're basically directly contracting with clean energy companies to say, we want to pay you to send us your clean power. So you're seeing a lot of growth there. There are sectors of the economy that are harder to electrify. The, you know, agriculture, the, you know, heavy manufacturing, mm-hmm, cement and steel, you know, those are technologies that need heat to run the machinery. And so, you know, there are efforts to think about how you can make hydrogen out of clean power that could be used to replace that fossil energy. So I think, you know, there's no part of the economy that is not eager for the benefits of clean power, but there are parts of the economy that electricity is not yet able to use to displace other fuels. And they're obviously a step behind.
But the potential is there.
Look, there's no problem that this country has not been able to solve with, you know, private sector investment and innovation. And so, you know, there's a lot of enthusiasm around green hydrogen, which would be a way of creating kind of a liquid fuel, mm-hmm, that had been made with zero carbon electricity. So it's basically like a zero carbon fuel that can go through pipelines and power a cement facility. So I think that's, you know, going to be an important part of the next 10, 20 years.
Really interesting in looking at where this industry is, where it is heading. Again, Jason Gramey is CEO of the American Clean Power Association. If folks are interested in learning more about the state of this industry and the potential that it holds, where would they get more information about your organization, Jason?
Love to send your listeners to two spots. One is a new website, fuelforthought.energy, which provides a lot of just kind of information about what's happening in communities around the country. If any of your listeners want to be a part of this great new workforce, as I mentioned, our companies need to hire 500,000 people in the next decade. And the place where you can learn about the job opportunities is cleanpowerinstitute.org. We would be delighted to help anybody become part of this growing industry.
Jason Gramey, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Been a pleasure. Thanks, Chris.
Well, from the Health and Medical File this morning, did you know that 1 in 5 people worldwide have inherited high lipoprotein A? And most don't know it because it is generally not screened for, meaning the first sign that people have of this condition is often a heart attack or stroke. Joining us this morning to help raise awareness are Dr. Amit Khera, Professor and Director of Preventive Cardiology at UT Southwestern Medical Center, and LP Little A patient and patient advocate for the Family Heart Foundation, Misty Votaw. Dr. Khera, let me start with you. I don't mean to sound flip about this, but a heart attack or a stroke would seem to be a bit extreme as a first sign. If 20% of the population has this, why isn't screening done as a matter of routine?
Yeah, a really important question. And unfortunately for heart disease and stroke, you don't generally feel anything. Often the first sign is having that heart attack or stroke. That's exactly why it's so important to raise awareness and get screened. You know, this lipoprotein A, genetics play a big role in heart disease. And lipoprotein A is a genetic cholesterol you inherit from your parents, meaning it's not about what you eat or what you do, it's how you get it. And about 1 in 5 people, or 60 million Americans, have this. Really an opportunity for screening and early detection, but less than 5% actually get it tested. So that's what we're here to talk about today.
Yeah, I want to focus in on that word inherited, as you were just alluding to, in inherited high lipoprotein A. How do genetics play a role in heart disease and stroke?
Yeah, you know, about half of heart disease, roughly, is related to genetics, meaning, you know, unfortunately, we get it from our parents and so forth. That's the unfortunate part. The flip side is that knowledge is free. It's the cheapest medical information you have. You know about your family history. So genetics play a big role. And lipoprotein A, why it's a little bit of a different type of cholesterol, is maybe up to 90% of the levels really have to do with your genes, not to do with usual diet and things that we think about.
Now, Misty, I want to bring you into the conversation here as well. Share your story and your experience with this.
Thank you for having me. So I knew that I had a family history, a strong family history. My father had a heart attack when he was 40. And a little bit later on, I lost my 36-year-old sister to heart disease. And wow. Then some years after that, my 48-year-old sister also passed away from a heart attack. And really, we didn't know anything up until that point. That's when I decided I really needed to figure out what was going on. And I was screened and found out that I had elevated Lp(a). Found the Family Heart Foundation at that point, and they helped me connect to, you know, physicians and just a community of people that would help me figure out and navigate my own health journey, but also my daughters, who also both have elevated Lp(a).
Mm. Dr. Khera, if you have this inherited elevated Lp(a), does that mean that a heart attack or a stroke is a foregone conclusion, or are there proactive things one can do to reduce the risk of heart disease and stroke, even with this added genetic risk factor?
Yeah, great question. You know, the first point is knowledge. You know, knowledge is power, and knowing that you have it, so getting screened, particularly if you have family members that have high Lp(a). But, you know, it's not destiny, meaning there are things you can do about it. We do know that although there's no direct treatments, those are coming hopefully in the next couple of years. But if one has high cholesterol, high blood pressure, other things like that, we really need to double down on our risk factors if we have a high lipoprotein A, because that'll make a big difference in lowering risk.
And Misty, talk a little bit about how you have, mitigated that risk and some of the changes that you have made to
the point that we were just talking about here?
Absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of it, like Dr. Kara said, is just knowing. And that way I kind of had an idea of what I needed to do and then getting that healthcare help that I needed and just kind of figuring out how to lower all of my other risks and just giving me the power to say, okay, you know, I need to be taking these medications or I need to be having this healthy lifestyle and watching what I'm eating and just really screening the whole family, figuring out where we needed to go from there and just making sure that we're all being as healthy as we can to get rid of all those risk factors.
As we mentioned, this is something that impacts roughly 20% of the population. Very few people know about it, however. Misty, you referenced the Family Heart Foundation as a sort of a clearinghouse for resources. What is that organization doing to address the gaps in care?
Well, you know, Misty and I have been working on this together, and so I'll tell you a little bit about that. You know, the Family Heart Foundation is really the premier patient organization that does advocacy, research, and helps, you know, identify screening opportunities. You know, this is Lipoprotein A Awareness Month. And so here we are raising awareness, which is the critical need. Mm-hmm. You know, we want people to get screened and it's a simple blood test. If they can't get that through the physician for whatever reason, we can through this Lipoprotein A Awareness Month, get that screening through the Family Heart Foundation website.
And where do we get more information? Where do we go to learn more?
You know, it's an easy website, findlpa.org.
Very good. As we always say with respect to medical information, best source of information is going to be your doctor, your family physician. However, we'll put a link up on our webpage for more general information from that website to get you started. Again, Dr. Ahmed Kara is professor and director of preventive cardiology at UT Southwestern Medical Center, and LP little a patient and patient advocate Misty Votal with us this morning for the Family Heart Foundation. Thank you both for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
So in case you missed it a couple of weeks ago on the program, we were talking about the annual benefit auction for Findlay's Hope House. Hope shines bright. It is actually happening this Friday evening, and the event itself is sold out now. There are no more tickets available, but you can still participate through the online auction that begins at noon today. A couple of weeks ago on the program, Lori Poland from Hope House dropped by to talk about why this event is so important for Hope House and the people they serve. Kind of makes us confront a rather uncomfortable reality that many of us are probably closer to that than we would like to admit. We're probably just one or two steps removed from being in that situation ourselves if we really thought about it.
You're right. And we saw that a lot with COVID. Mm-hmm. You know, people were going to work. They're living their life. They're paying their bills. Everything's fine. And all of a sudden, I went to work today. And both my wife and I no longer have jobs.
Yeah.
It's why the eviction prevention dollars we got back in 2020 were so important, and why we have continued to ask for eviction prevention dollars, because we really feel like sometimes people just need that little bridge, there's just a little gap that needs a little bridge to get them over the hump to the other side and can stop a catastrophic change in their life, which would be eviction.
So how do you do that? Because, again, there is the immediate, as you mentioned, preventing eviction to the extent that you can, or the immediate of providing those who are homeless with somewhere to go. But that's only the beginning of addressing the problem.
So we feel like, and we know that it works, the case management side, case managers are licensed social workers. They walk beside our clients, you know, kind of grab them by the arm and say, we're doing this and I'm going to help you through this. Because it's easy to write a check and say, here, landlord, here's the rent for these people. Mm-hmm. It's a lot harder to say, we're going to help you pay your rent and then we're going to help you figure out, how did you get here? What are you going to do when you're in our program? And how are you going to stay independent when you leave?
Yeah.
You know, when we're no longer assisting you.
Right.
Because most of our programs are short-term programs because they're meant to bridge that gap to assist people as they go on their way. It's not to pay your rent for the rest of your life or to allow you to have a crutch. It's we are building a foundation there. And the over 80% of the people that we serve that successfully complete our programs are still housed a year later. So whatever, you know, guidance they didn't have before, we're giving them more tools in their toolbox so that they can stay on their own 2 feet. And what a lot of people don't understand, Chris, is that some of our the people that we serve did not have the gifts that we had growing up. They didn't have that guidance, someone to teach them about what is your responsibility as a renter, what is the landlord's responsibility as your landlord, the importance of so many things that we have a foundation for in middle class that some of these folks just don't have. Some of them do have it, but a lot of them do not, and so it doesn't occur to them sometimes to live life in a different way because this is what they've known. So we're trying to help them find a better way. And it works.
Yeah.
And we've been doing it for over 30 years.
You mentioned that COVID was one thing that sort of exacerbated the problem or highlighted the problem or, all of a sudden you get an influx. Mm-hmm. But how common is this in Hancock County?
How common is homelessness?
Yeah.
So the annual point in time count for 2023, which is a national count that happens in January across the nation, in Hancock County, we could count, and mind you, it's January, so, and when people see you coming, it's not like they're running out saying, hey, I'm here.
Right.
So
by the very nature, it makes it difficult to count.
Yes, but right. It is what it is.
Yeah.
And Hope House works with the other entities in the community, also the police and the sheriff, to go out and physically count. In 2023, it was 171 folks in Hancock County. Hmm. That is an increase of, I believe, 72% in the past 5 years.
Wow.
So homelessness is a problem. It's not like, and we are what we call rural homelessness. A lot of people are what we call couch surfing. They're living on somebody's couch, or they're staying in a porch.
Not sleeping in doorways.
Correct.
Necessarily. Mm-hmm. Although there are some instances of people who sleep outside, sleep in the parks or what have you. But we don't have the tent cities.
Right. It's right.
Not so like that makes it also more easier to sort of think that it doesn't happen.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because it's really not in our face, but we do have a lack of housing in Hancock County, which is a nationwide problem. And until we can build more residential housing, either multiple units or just housing, we're going to have a problem with finding enough places for people to lay their head at night.
We've got more of a silent problem or an unseen problem here as compared to maybe some urban centers. And again, you mentioned the percentages or the statistics. Mm-hmm. The after effects from COVID may still be throwing that off a little bit, but the main point is that this is not a problem from which we are immune
in
the community. So again, hence the important work of Hope House and the importance of the benefit auction, because as you mentioned, it is the largest fundraiser. So so that goes into like the eviction prevention fund,
it goes into our programming.
Okay.
Funding. So we do have gaps in our programs. I mean, we are a United Way agency. We get a lot of, we get state grants. I write a lot of private grants along with some of my coworkers. And of course, we get individual grants and monetary donations, also donations of in-kind goods. But this really helps fill a gap in our funding. So we do have some nice prizes. I mean, there's a week's stay at a brand new home in Paso Robles, California.
Oh, wow.
We've got some artwork. We always have artwork from our residents who
very
donate
cool.
Their talent to help us create something special.
Very
so
cool.
There are a lot of different things that are available. So you can go to our website, www.findleyhopehouse.org, and there's a link. You can register on there.
Again, part of our conversation with Lori Poland of Hope House about their annual benefit auction, which, again, is Friday. The event is sold out, but the online auction that anyone can participate in begins today. And if you head to our webpage, goodmornings.net, we have a link there where you can see all of the items up for bid in the online auction. You can register for that auction and place your bid to help out the folks at Hope House. Again, go to goodmornings.net to learn more.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
We interrupt this program to bring you a broken news alert.
Police in Lakewood, New Jersey didn't have to look too hard to find the suspect who destroyed a restaurant at a local golf course this weekend. All they had to do was search for the naked guy. Apparently, a 29-year-old man was walking around Maggie's Bar and Grill on Sunday morning, breaking things all while naked.
He was smashing bottles and breaking glasses and a whole lot more. That strikes me as very dangerous. You'll be breaking glass while you're naked. That can, you can really hurt yourself that way. That is very dangerous. Apparently caused some $100,000 in damage, all told. $100,000 worth of damages. Police were able to find the naked individual, who they described as a person. They didn't give his name in the report, or at least not in the report here. They described the man as being in emotional distress. He was charged with burglary and criminal mischief, and he was taken for further evaluation, let's say. Just look for the naked guy. Speaking of naked guys, it's a big day for naked guys in the broken news this morning. A Florida man gave police more than they bargained for when he argued that he was allowed to be drunk and disorderly and to sit naked in a trash can on a public sidewalk. Why are you sitting naked in a trash can on a public sidewalk? I'm allowed. Wiley James Weeks, age 35, was arrested by St. Petersburg police after cops discovered him intoxicated, unsteady on his feet, and reeking of alcohol late Saturday night. He was extricated from the trash can and arrested for disorderly intoxication and resisting arrest. He pleaded guilty on both counts and was fined $520. Apparently, this is not his first run-in with the law. His prior convictions include theft, disorderly conduct, panhandling, criminal mischief, and other misdemeanors. Apparently, though, this is the first time he had been found naked in a trash can. So, why are you sitting naked in a trash can? I'm allowed. Alrighty then. Enough of the naked guys. A judge in Los Angeles has dismissed a lawsuit that a man filed against members of a Facebook dating group who called him a bad date. It was the first of several lawsuits filed by Stuart Murray against more than 50 women earlier this year. He accused members of this private group on Facebook called Are We Dating the Same Guy? He accused them of defamation, libel, sex-based discrimination, and more. On Monday, a judge ruled there is no evidence of conspiracy and granted a motion which aims to prevent people who speak out from being silenced through the use of frivolous lawsuits. The judge also says, based on the evidence, there is no possibility of Mr. Murray winning any of winning his suit against any of the defendants. There is no way that his claims can be substantiated. So essentially, is the judge confirming that he is, in fact, a bad date? That's what it sounds like to me. I can't imagine why these women might have thought that Mr. Murray was a bad date. I mean, just because he sued them. Can't imagine why they found him to be a bad date. He seems like such a wonderful and caring individual. From the international file of the broken news this morning, Scottish police responding to reports of an armed man on board the train to Dundee at the Aberdeen station discovered that the man described as an armed man turned out to actually be a Star Wars fan dressed in a stormtrooper costume. Turns out he was on his way to a comic book convention when his costume drew some unwanted attention. He later posted online that his train was stopped and he was approached by an officer who realized pretty early on that the alleged firearm was really a fake blaster and just part of the costume. The man said when the train returned to the station, he was met by two firearms officers, three officers from the Scotland police and two British transport police. They took the man home to get a bag for his blaster so as not to alarm his fellow train passengers in the future. They said, just put it in a bag. So you don't scare people. He was also asked not to wear his full stormtrooper armor on the train. So as not to alarm anyone unnecessarily. I don't know. He might think of just taking an Uber the next time. You know, that's just take an Uber. And finally, in the broken news this morning, this is one of the greatest stories that I think we have seen so far this year in the broken news. I love this. And kudos to the employee at a museum in Germany, Munich, Germany, the Pinakothek der Modern Museum. So I'm guessing the Museum of Modern Art in Munich, Germany. I don't speak German or anything, but I'm guessing from the context, that's what it is. Modern Art Museum, Munich, Germany. An employee at the museum decided to take advantage of his employment opportunity by hanging up his artwork there in the gallery. He figured, well, I'm an employee of the museum. I'll just frame my artwork and hang it up in the gallery. In fact, the piece that he hung of his own was actually up for 8 hours before anyone actually figured it out. The museum confirmed that the 51-year-old man had been fired after he was found to have put his own art on display in a gallery dedicated to modern and contemporary art. The man snuck his work in hopes of achieving his artistic breakthrough. I'd say mission accomplished, you know? I mean, was hanging there for 8 hours before, you know, a full day before anyone noticed it. So I'd say mission accomplished there. He lost his job, but that's... kudos for the ingenuity there. That is today's broken news report. An update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
Did you know more than 80 million Americans depend on AM radio for their news, traffic, weather, sports, and a community connection? AM radio is the backbone of the emergency alert system, keeping Americans safe in dangerous times. This is News Director Matt Demchek. AM 1330 WFIN is here to serve you, and we take seriously our commitment to our listeners. We would love to hear what you value most about AM radio. Visit WeAreBroadcasters.com and tell us how you depend on AM.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives are coming up on summer vacation season. If you're planning your family getaway for the summer months, would you rather drive or fly to your destination? New research finds that nearly 3/4 of Americans actually prefer driving to their vacation destination. This is a poll of 2,000 Americans. Most preferred the open road. And why, you might ask? I mean, flying certainly is more convenient, right, in most cases. But road trippers say the best part of hitting the open road include seeing new landscapes. 50% said seeing new landscapes. 43% said listening to music. You can do that on a plane, but that's what they said. 26% said getting a break from the routine. And I'm guessing that would include, you know, being able to stop along the way as opposed to being stuck on a plane where you can't really, you know, pull over and take a break, stretch your legs, that kind of thing. So getting a break from the routine, 26%. 25% said they just enjoy driving. They just enjoy that getting there is half the fun sort of thing. The one thing they didn't ask, and I think they really should have in this poll, is what is your tipping point between driving and flying? I mean, for me, it's like 7-8 hours. If it takes 7 or 8 hours to drive to a destination, you may as well just drive rather than fly, because by the time you have to get to the airport, get on the plane, get to your destination, get your luggage, get your rental car,
and start your vacation, that's going to take 7 hours anyway. So if it's, you know what I mean? It's 7-8 hours. If it's more than that, you know, driving across the country, I'd rather fly. But if you're just, you know, driving to the Carolinas or something, maybe it's just better to drive. Well, you know, of late, we've spent so much time talking about the sun and the moon and the eclipse. Let's take a little time to talk about Earth this morning. It is not a coincidence that Earth Day falls this month in April. It's the same month that we typically come out of hibernation and starting enjoying the great outdoors again. And so joining us this morning to talk about creating a beautiful and sustainable outdoor space are Dr. Lakshmi Gopinath, turf scientist at the Scotts Miracle-Gro Company, and Dr. Kelly Cope from Utah State University's Center for Water Efficient Landscaping. Dr. Gopinath, let me start with you. What steps can homeowners take to sustainably establish and maintain their lawn?
So the first step is to pick the right grass for that particular climate. So for Toledo, which is in the northern part of the country, cool season grasses are a great choice. So grasses like tall fescue, Kentucky bluegrass, perennial ryegrass are great options for Toledo, Ohio. The next one is the timing of your management practices. So spring is a great time to start managing your lawns. As you know, April is the National Lawn Care Month. So when your plants are actually coming out of the winter dormancy, they're greening up. So at this point, it's a great time to actually feed your lawns with the Turf Builder lawn food. And spring is a great time to seed. So once you know which grass type you're going to pick, just grab a bag of the Turf Builder grass seed product. And then coming to management, mowing is one of the key practices that we need to follow. Make sure that you're mowing your lawn at a higher height so that it can encourage deeper rooting, so that your lawns are ready to take up all the stressful condition that it's going to face during the summer months.
Yeah, I know that's one of the key things that a lot of people do wrong. They cut their lawns too low, too early, thinking that that way they can avoid having to mow so often when it's growing so crazy. I mean, it seems like, you know, we get these April showers and it just goes like crazy. But that is a very important point. We want to make sure that we remind folks on. Kelly, talk about why sustainability, the sustainability part of this is important.
So we get so many sustainability benefits from our green spaces. So those would include things like absorbing carbon dioxide, releasing oxygen, preventing soil erosion, allowing stormwater to infiltrate and not enter other water bodies where it can create pollution. And then we also actually get quite a few quality of life benefits. For example, if you're out there playing, socializing, maybe you're throwing the ball for your dog, you're out being active in that space and it reduces stress and has other psychological benefits as well. We also have a lot of atmospheric cooling associated with green spaces. So having that green space around our homes, around our schools, and our workplaces helps to reduce the cooling costs for those spaces and save energy. And something that I'm really excited about these days is that over the past couple of decades, there has been a lot of research and work done to develop low water use grasses. And so where I live in this part of the country, water is a great concern, of course,
right,
but it is a great concern right across the country. So anytime we can use grasses that require less water but still provide that functionality, that's a good thing. And the last thing that I'll leave you with in terms of benefits has to do with the stormwater again, and the fact that if we can stop stormwater from running off of our landscapes and allow that water to infiltrate, it can actually eventually reach groundwater and improve groundwater levels, which is another issue that we face nationally.
It's interesting hearing you talk about all of those too, because I was thinking, I know some hardcore environmentalists who say that any kind of home lawn is a bad thing. But again, hearing you talk, there are some really important benefits that you really only get with that natural green space around our homes and so on.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, if it's one message that I would love to share with everyone, it is that. It's that we get an enormous amount of benefit from the grasses in our landscapes and our landscapes in general. And so they are to be celebrated, they are to be shared and enjoyed, and I hope folks will take that to heart.
So anything else that we can advise people, any advice for folks here in Northwest Ohio in this first part of spring when everything is kind of coming back to life and people are getting out and doing that early yard work? Anything else that they need to keep in mind this time of year?
So timing of seeding is of critical importance. So we need to put the seed down, especially in, the Ohio, Toledo, Ohio. It should be, the air temperature should be somewhere between 60 degrees Fahrenheit and 80 degrees Fahrenheit.
Okay.
So I think we're not quite there yet. So timing is the key for having a successful seed, turf establishment from seed.
Yeah, I would just add to that, if folks can postpone that first irrigation, if they're thinking about using supplemental irrigation, it's a good time to postpone that and allow the grass to develop roots more deeply into the soil so that it has access to moisture deeper in the soil and can enter the summer months in good shape. And then taking advantage of technologies out there. So there are weather-based irrigation controllers now that take the guesswork out of irrigation scheduling. There are pressure-regulating sprinklers, a lot of different technologies that can be used in the landscape to improve the overall sustainability.
Again, Dr. Lakshmi Gopinath, turf scientist with the Scotts Miracle-Gro Company, Dr. Kelly Cope from Utah State University's Center for Water Efficient Landscaping. Where do we get more information?
For more information, you can go into scotts.com.
All right. Ladies, thank you both for taking the time this morning. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program once again. Remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the program at our webpage. Check us out online at goodmornings.net. Coming up tomorrow on the program, how many streaming services do you subscribe to? Do you even know? With all the price hikes of the past couple of years, there's a good chance you may be paying more than the cable bill you are getting rid of. We'll talk about how to avoid the subscription creep that often comes with cord cutting. So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.